I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome back to Radio Times. Creativity has been associated with the right side of the brain and with a starving, suffering artist. But with advances in neuroscience and psychology, we're learning that creativity is much more complex than that and much more interesting. Scott Barry Kaufman and Carolyn Gregoire decided to investigate the creative process and found that artists have traits in common, including something they call messy minds. Their book is titled Wired to Create, Unraveling the Mysteries of the Creative Mind, and it's broken down into chapters on passion, daydreaming, solitude, intuition, turning adversity into advantage. Scott Barry Kaufman joins us here in our Philadelphia studio, scientific director of the Imagination Institute, also a researcher at the Positive Psychology Center at the University of Pennsylvania. And Scott Barry Kaufman, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Great to be here.
Nice to have you here. So what's a messy mind? Let's start there.
You know, I think a lot of people have a mind that they kind of mix and match lots of different seemingly incompatible things. So they may be really extroverted when they're performing or when they're engaged in what they're doing. But then outside of that activity, they seem really introverted, or they may seem highly, highly sensitive, but they also have a lot of resiliency and can really stand up and face a lot of things, like a lot of obstacles that come along our way. And these are just some examples of the kind of seeming contradictions that creative people or messy minds, I should say, can reconcile through their creative process.
And by messy minds, I mean, it sounds like what you're talking about is not someone with, you know, multiple personality disorder or anything like that, but having sort of multiple parts of who they are, and it gets expressed in different kinds of ways, perhaps depending on the setting, who they're with, what they're doing.
Absolutely. All of us have these fundamental drives, and I think that most people don't really get in touch with their true selves or get in touch with all these different sides of themselves. Creative people, and I do think anyone can be a creative person, but people who are really out there living the creative life tend to be very comfortable getting in touch with all sides of themselves. Basically, they get very intimate with themselves.
What's interesting, and I said that in the introduction, I remember that book, you know, Drawing on the Right Side of the Brain or something like that. What you say in this book is that if we're talking about creativity, it really involves not just a portion of the brain, but perhaps the entire brain or many more portions than what we thought.
Yeah, I think there's this great myth that it's a left brain, right brain thing, you know, that if your right brain is the right brain is very poetic and sensual and colorful, and your left brain is black and white and boring and realistic. And what we're seeing is that it's more important to look at brain networks. And brain networks are, you know, a lot of different parts of the brain act together as a team player to solve certain problems. And different stages of the creative process, these different brain regions do come together, and different brain networks are active and deactive depending on what you're doing.
And is it a matter of you know, MRIs and just literally looking at how the brain lights up when someone is, what, painting or writing a poem or...
You really know your stuff, Marty.
Well, it's my job.
That's cool. fMRI is a we can use MRI, we can use fMRI, we can look at structural and functional. So we can look at the brain activations while we're engaging in the creative process. So they've put rappers in the fMRI machine, for instance.
Oh, wow.
They've put jazz improvisers and have them do their thing. And we're starting to see what the brain looks like when people are doing these sorts of things.
And is it really just sort of it's scattered and lighting up in different kinds of ways?
Well, again, it depends on what stage or what the person's doing. So when rappers, for instance, are improvising, you see a part of the brain active that indicate you see a pattern in the brain that indicates that they're in high flow. And the flow state is something that's been known to be really important for creativity. It's your ability to ignore distractions and be fully in the moment, fully absorbed. Time goes by quickly. But when they're asked to remember something from the past, so not improvise, but remember something, recall something, you see that their brain network associated with concentration and focus is much more active.
Is there a link between creativity and intelligence? Of course, knowing that intelligence comes in many different forms. It isn't just this IQ number, but, you know, can show up in different kinds of ways. Is it a certain kind of intelligence?
Yeah, and, you know, IQ... is a certain kind of measure of intelligence. It doesn't fully capture intelligence, but it measures an important slice of intelligence, like your ability to concentrate and focus. And up to a certain point, IQ is related to creativity. There's a correlation, but it's not as high as people think. And IQ is not the full explanation of creativity, and that's a big reason why we wrote this book, because we want to talk about all these other exciting things. Some people may find IQ exciting, that's fine, but there are lots of other exciting things too that contribute to creativity.
Well, let's talk about play, and let's talk about children.
I love play.
Well, I do too, but at the same time, you know, especially if you get older, you wonder, have I carved out enough time for play? But what can children teach us about play and creativity?
Yeah, children have this natural drive for creativity. They have this natural drive to just engage with the world and with each other. And it gets knocked out of us a lot as we get older. And a lot of adults don't play. You know, a lot of listeners may, you know, it might be important for them to reflect on their life and realize that, gosh, my whole life really has become work, you know?
And not enough play.
Yeah, and really just the recognition of that. There should be play therapy interventions. I just made that up. But, I mean, in the sense that for adults, I just thought of that. But I feel like there should be, you know, or like if it dawns on you that you're like an adult and all you do is work, you go somewhere and allows you to play. I actually have a friend who started a preschool for adults
in Manhattan. I love it.
Yeah, she started. Her and her friend started a preschool for adults in Manhattan, and adults can sign up and they get messy, you know, physically messy with paint.
Like finger painting and things like that. Well, I wanted to spend a little bit more time on children and play, because for some, you know, play is video games, and I don't think you're really talking about that. You're really talking more about imaginative play, pretend and play.
That's right. I'm not talking about like rough and tumble play or you push people down in the sandbox. Well, maybe that's the kind of play that people did to me in my childhood.
I was going to say, I think you just revealed something about yourself, but that's okay.
But I'll tell you more about being playful in your thoughts. You know, thinking about all sorts of different possibilities and creative ideas and all different ways that things can go and the way that your future can go. And, a lot of people that are really good at this are improvisers, like comedy improvisers. You know, if you've ever seen a comedy improv show.
Absolutely.
They're so good at, like, you know, at just being playful in everything that they process in the world. You know, they're trained to do that. But there's no reason why we can't be trained to do that outside of that context, you know.
We're talking about kids and then talking about adults, and in between, of course, are schools. I mean, in certain ways, are schools responsible for sort of knocking some of the creativity, the sort of natural wired to create creativity in kids, knock it out of them?
Yeah, the way that's – yeah, well, especially the standardized testing is really, really detrimental to creativity, but it's also really detrimental to well-being. And this is something I care deeply about as well. I teach a course at Penn on positive psychology where I try to teach the kids, what does it mean to live a good life? And I see creativity as a really important element of living a good life. And as I see creativity and well-being as tightly intertwined, despite the popular notions of the madness genius link and stuff like that, I actually view creativity as a fundamental human drive that we don't get expressed in school.
And in school, as you say, and in certain ways, I don't think you can entirely fault schools. I mean, kids need to learn sort of basic reading, writing, and arithmetic. But these tests are about analyzing material, right, and coming up with the right answer. What you say in this book is that creativity requires more insightful thought, where you go, as opposed to the kind of, here's the answer to X, Y, and Z.
Great question. Yeah, you know, our greatest creative ideas don't come when we're focusing intensely on the problem. You know, it really comes when we're kind of step away from it and allow our associations to wander, our mind to wander, daydreaming, dare I say.
Yeah, daydreaming. Well, you even say, and this I found so interesting, is that and people will say, I get my best ideas in the shower. And you say there's actually an interesting explanation for that, why people get some of their better or best ideas in the shower.
Yeah, I did a large international study with a popular showerhead company, Hansgrohe.
Really?
Yeah. And we found that people reported that they got more creative inspiration. 72% said they got more creative inspiration in the shower than they did at work.
So what does that tell us?
So I think it suggests that, you know, it's not just the shower in particular, but it's any sort of activity that allows us to get out of our ordinary experience and out of our everyday, focus on a problem, and allows our mind to relax a little bit. You know, the relaxation element is really important, mm-hmm. You know. Some of our most creative mindset is that moment just before we're about to fall off to sleep, you know. And there's a reason for that, you know. It's allowing us to get into that flow state. It's allowing us to get our critic, our inner critic, to
shut up.
Yeah. I'm glad you stopped me before I cursed on live radio. But yeah, absolutely.
Sometimes the producers on Radio Times, you know, they can't sort of get a show to congeal, or they're waiting for someone to call them back, or they're just waiting for an idea. They will literally go take a walk. And I swear to you, they come back in the office and they have like 7 ideas. Is that the same kind of thing as taking a shower?
So. Yeah, taking a walk is also a really important thing. Some of the greatest minds of all time took a hike and to their great benefit. Darwin walked along a path in nature and got a lot of his ideas about nature,
you know, right.
from his walks. There's a great benefit to solitude. There's also a great benefit to collaboration. I don't mean to say that collaboration is bad. I think that a major point I want to make here is that creativity does involve all these things. And you know, anyone who says I've discovered the secret to creativity is wrong, because there isn't the secret.
Right. Yeah. But the title of your book is Wired to Create. So what you and your co-author are saying is that we're designed or set up to be creative.
I think so. Yeah, I think our brains are wired to make meaning out of our experiences. In this book, I think we tie creativity a lot to meaning and identity development. Especially, you know, in the passion chapter, we talk about something called harmonious passion, where mm-hmm. creativity is part of our identity in a healthy way. And I think what's interesting is that the same brain network that seems to be uniquely associated with imagination is also uniquely associated with meaning.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation, talking with Scott Barry Kaufman. He's co-author of a new book with Carolyn Gregoire, and it's titled Wired to Create, subtitled Unraveling the Mysteries of the Creative Mind. And we are talking about some of the findings in this book about creativity, and we are also opening up the lines at 1-888-477-9499 to join our conversation. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, as Josephine just did. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen, talking with Scott Barry Kaufman about creativity, what makes someone creative. He has co-authored a new book called Wired to Create, Unraveling the Mysteries of the Creative Mind. It's about certain traits and practices that distinguish creative minds from non-creative minds, if I can put it that way. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. As I said in my introduction, they do break their book down into chapters on things like passion and daydreaming and solitude. We mentioned that as well. And again, you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. You mentioned daydreaming. I'm all in for it.
I love daydreaming.
I do too, but it's kind of a maligned activity, it seems. If you're daydreaming, you're not working, you're not doing something.
In this standardized testing culture, that is the case. You know, there's time and place for all these things we talk about in the book. There's a time and place for daydreaming. There's time, you know, when you're taking your SATs, you don't want to daydream. When you're you know, whatever. I can think of lots of other examples. So a lot of them inappropriate are going through my head right now. But when you're doing lots of things, you don't want to be daydreaming, right? But there are times when it's really good to daydream, when it's really good to get in touch with your inner stream of consciousness, as William James would put it, you know, the founder of the field of psychology.
And the idea is just to let your mind go, right? Not be a, you know, don't police your thoughts.
Exactly. Be non-judgmentally aware of your inner stream of consciousness, your future strivings, your unresolved issues. There's forms of meditation that you can do to get in touch with that.
How is that related to mindfulness? I mean, everyone seems to be talking about mindfulness now, but how do you see those two things? Daydreaming and mindfulness.
I'll be honest with you. Over the past year,
we're all about honesty here.
Past year and a half of my life or so, I've gone from being quite critical of mindfulness and being all about daydreaming to having quite a deep appreciation for mindfulness and its many forms. I think that it's, like I said, there is a time and place for everything. We talk in the book about the middle way. Right. And, you know, researching this book changed my mind a lot about this. You know, I'm open to science and new research, and you know, I try to stay as objective as possible, you know, as much as I can, and it does seem that there is a good middle way where you build up the skills to be able to focus when you want, and that's what mindfulness can be really great for, is allowing you to have control of your attention, to have flexible attention, but at the same time, sometimes you want to be in control of your daydreams.
Right.
Sometimes you want to mindful daydreaming, you know, where you let your mind wander, you daydream and you look for larger patterns and themes that it might reveal about yourself and your life, and that's important too.
I mean, what I think of mindfulness is literally paying attention. I mean,
absolutely.
If it's sort of boiled down to its essentialness, it's about paying attention, which is, I think, a lot harder than people think.
I think I would go one step further, and we talk about it in the book. It's observing.
Observing.
And I think that can be different than paying attention. It's processing things in a really meaningful way. I think that's what's key to mindfulness.
You also say in this book that we need new and unusual experiences to think differently. I mean, there was that, was it Apple campaign, Think Different?
Yeah.
But the openness to experience seems to be really central to creativity.
Absolutely central. Openness to experience can take many different forms, from intellectual curiosity to appreciation of beauty to imagination. Take all different forms, but it's absolutely important for creativity.
I mean, some people I think are naturally maybe curious or willing to take risks, and others not so much. Can you train yourself to be more open to new experiences? Is that something people can do if they want to feel more creative or be more creative?
I don't know if you can train yourself to be more open, but you can make a decision that you're going to wake up, you know, and you're going to live a life, a creative life, where you're going to be open to new experiences. You're going to embrace challenges. You're going to just, you know, seize the day sort of thing and be curious and be mindful and appreciate the beauty that exists in this world. You can make a choice. I think openness to experience, I think creativity is a choice. The creative lifestyle is a choice. All these things we talk about in the book are habits that creative people do, that any one of us can create. I don't think we want to teach openness to experience like a curriculum.
Exactly. But you know what? I mean, some people seem to be naturally that way.
They do. Some people seem to be naturally any of these habits.
Right.
Or any habits at all. But that's all what we're learning about personality. If I can geek out a second.
Go ahead.
Is that all?
This is NPR. You can geek out all you
want.
Yay!
All personality traits, all of them, all of our who we are just habits anyway. You know, people get too stuck in labels. They say, I'm an introvert, and then they never leave their room. You know?
Mentally leave their room. Yeah.
You know, and when in fact, you are what you do, And that's what we know about personality. You know, it's patterns of behavior. Your patterns of behavior can say you're an introvert, and that's totally fine, but it doesn't need to limit you. There can still be moments when you decide to dance on the tabletop or whatever, I don't know, just get crazy, you know? And there's no reason why you can't change these patterns of behaviors through experience.
Also about openness to experience has a dopamine effect. I mean, there's a reason why we feel the way we do because of dopamine.
Hmm. Love that you brought up dopamine.
It's right there.
Love that. Yeah, dopamine, a lot of people treat dopamine as like the sex, drugs, and rock and roll molecule, or like it's pleasure. And that's a mischaracterization of dopamine, actually. Dopamine actually, what it really does is it influences our expectations of pleasure, but not the experience of pleasure itself. So when dopamine is coursing through our system, we're expecting a positive outcome. The outcome itself might not be positive at all,
right,
but we're expecting a positive outcome. And there's different kinds of dopamine projections. And long story short, the kind that's very relevant to creativity in particular is the kind that has to do with information seeking. So dopamine, we're discovering in recent years that dopamine can actually be really important for increasing your drive and excitement to experience information, to understand, to comprehend the world and learn something and discover.
That's so interesting because we do live in this information world now, and we have access to so much information. I can't tell you how many times, you know, I've been out with friends and we say, well, who was the guy that did X, Y, and Z? And we all whip out our phones and, you know, we have access to this information. It's terrific.
Yeah. It's also can be a curse.
It can be a curse as well. Let me get Wade from Northeast Philadelphia to join our conversation. And Wade, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah. Hi, Marty.
Hi there.
I have enjoyed throughout my life, you know, just gazing out the window as I drive along, and I've driven a lot of miles in my life, and feel that that is aided in my creative nature and, mm-hmm. you know, thoughts and ideas coming to me. It's maddening to me to look at the cars driving by and see everybody's face buried in a phone. And so I just want to ask your guests, how does that activity affect the brain and the mind and that potentially creative nature of being able to just kind of let go and let the mind wander and let creative notions kind of just bubble up as they will.
Wade, I appreciate the call to Radio Times.
I hope he's not driving right now.
I was going to say, I worry when I see people driving on their phones, not because of creativity, but just because are they paying attention to the road? But go ahead, Scott.
Yeah, I think that engaging in social media and all that stuff can really get in the way of us tapping into our deepest selves and the benefits that, you know, the great psychologists of even going back to Winnicott in the 50s, 60s talked about the value for getting in touch with yourself. I think a lot of this stuff can, you know, Facebook and the constant alerts, they're really taking us away from ourselves, and they're kind of setting up a false self. In a way, they're creating up a kind of self where we are projecting an identity, but we're not actually being our identity.
But don't you think all this stuff, I mean, in moderation, I mean,
yes,
no one's going to throw away their cell phone or bury their computer because they're not being their authentic self. I mean, in many ways, these are tools that can connect
us to
amplify
our authentic self.
Absolutely. Yeah.
That's true. No, that's absolutely true. I just assumed that the caller was referring to the excess of it.
Right. Yeah. Well, there's a lot of it, no question. Let me just quickly reintroduce you. Scott Barry Kaufman is our guest. He's co-author of a new book called Wired to Create, Unraveling the Mysteries of the Creative Mind. And he's scientific director of the Imagination Institute, also a researcher at the Positive Psychology Center at the University of Pennsylvania. And you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me read a Facebook comment from Josephine. Isn't the appeal of alcohol and marijuana that there is a release of social mental confinement and predisposes us towards creativity? I guess, is there a connection between mind-altering substances and creativity?
That's a controversial question, but yes, there is. And I think it's unfortunate that the federal government has stopped research on that topic, because I know some people like Fadiman, James Fadiman, and others, colleagues. I've seen some of their research when they were starting to do some of those studies in the 60s and 70s, and found that people did at least report that they felt more creative. In some instances, after they got out of the drugs, they looked at what they did and said, wow, this wasn't creative at all. But it does increase the feeling of being more open and free. And so there is some research on that. And alcohol, again, in moderation, does lower the prefrontal cortex areas that we know can get in the way of the flow state. So one glass of wine, I'll say, while you're writing, could be very beneficial to creativity.
Let me ask you about insight. Then we'll get back to our callers about what insight is. People often associate that with aha. You know, you have that sort of moment of recognition. How do you see insight?
Insight is kind of like a holistic shift of perception. It's like it seems to happen in a moment where this aha experience, where your whole frame of mind the complete gestalt has been shifted. And what's going on there is the unconscious, it's not magical. Your unconscious is always at work trying to get a bigger picture, trying to fit the pieces together for you of the jigsaw puzzle. Your consciousness is only aware of very, very minute portion of conscious of your entire being. The insight process is most likely to happen when your subconscious reaches a threshold of understanding that seems to create a complete picture. And it might not be right. It doesn't always have to be right, but it has that feeling, that characteristic of I suddenly see something.
You also say, and I find this really interesting, that there might be some connection to the visual cortex. Think about it. You write.
I love the visual cortex.
Well, sometimes when you're so close to a solution, you may even squint your eyes as you desperately search for it.
Yeah.
But this connection, and I know that experience of just whether there's something about sight and insight that's connected.
Yeah. Fascinating question. We almost need to shut off our visual cortex, though, for the insight to occur.
I mean, literally shut our eyes?
Yeah. Yeah, because a lot of this external input is getting in the way of getting in touch with our deepest associations and idea, our subconscious. That requires going deep within. By the way, as a callback, that is why showering is beneficial, because it allows us to filter out lots of external distractions and things.
But is there some connection between sight and insight, do you think?
Well, in that passage you read, it has to do with the inverse, like turning off the sight aspect. Insight does require often shutting off the visual system. So in that sense, I would say there's a connection. Yeah.
Let me see what Bill from Ballykinwood has to say. Bill, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning. Speaking of getting in the way of, I guess, the flow, I'm a 77-year-old painter illustrator, and I know my experience has been that quite often, even though I've been there many times, I find myself procrastinating. Huh. I'd like to know your guest's comments about or thoughts about that whole process as it relates to creativity.
Yeah. Bill, you're not alone in that. Scott, any thoughts?
Well, I hate to say that we found recently in a study with Angela Duckworth that grit, which is the passion and perseverance for long-term goals, is like one of the best predictors of creative achievement. However, what we talk about in this book is not necessarily like publicly recognized creative achievement, but living a creative lifestyle. And that's something that so there's an upside to this, sir. There's an upside to this. That to live a creative lifestyle, it's you can reconceptualize procrastination as part of the creative process. It's a framing issue. I would not beat yourself up over it so much and be so hard on yourself. But a lot of things that we view as procrastination are actually times where the subconscious can try to figure out a gestalt or figure out an insight and something like that. So we're learning more and more about the brain is that idle time is not – seemingly idle time is not a necessary wasted time.
I mean, I guess there is a point at which if procrastination goes on for maybe months or even years, I mean, something you do want to do but you don't do it, then that raises – it seems to me another
set of – If you have specific goals.
Yes. And for whatever reason, you're not getting to that goal.
Yeah.
You also look at – and oftentimes creative people have been seen as having some form of mental illness. Mm-hmm. Yes, I mean Van Gogh and there are others as well. Is there some kind of a connection between creativity and mental illness?
There's some fascinating connections between the two. Mental illness is not necessary or sufficient for creativity, but it seems like the kind of mind – that that is bent in the direction of mental illness in the way that we it defined as inability or deviation from reality is also the kind of mind that can lead to great creative ideas. Mm-hmm. So there is overlap. That is true, even though mental illness is not necessary. But when we look at the brain, we see that there's a similarity between people with schizophrenia and creative people in that their imagination brain network or their I like to call it the imagination brain network, and we could just call it that. Scientists call it the default mode network, but I like the imagination network. Is highly active all the time, and it can be contagion with reality. But the difference is that really creative people also have the ability to rein that in and to think about it and see whether or not it is reality, whether it's too out there. Whereas people that we put in mental institutions tend to have similar brain networks, the imagination brain network active, but they don't have these other controls or supports that could help them channel it in a creative way.
Well, let's take another short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. We are talking about creativity with our guest, Scott Barry Kaufman, again, a co-author of a new book with Carolyn Gregoire, and it's called Wired to Create, Unraveling the Mysteries of the Creative Mind. And again, he is scientific director of the Imagination Institute, also a researcher at the Positive Psychology Center at the University of Pennsylvania. And again, you can join the conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Scott Barry Kaufman about creativity, what is known today, what we're learning from neuroscience, also from psychology, seeing creativity as a much more complex process than it was considered a number of decades ago, both more mysterious and more paradoxical and, frankly, more interesting. Let me get Joel from Center City, Philadelphia to join us. And Joel, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Oh, thank you. In the introduction, you had talked about a chapter of the book related something to tragedy and creativity, and then your guest talked about finding meaning. The topic of post-traumatic growth is near and dear to me. I'm just wondering if your guest has any thoughts about that.
I'm sure he does. Joel, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Scott, you want to respond?
Great question. We actually have a whole chapter on post-traumatic growth in the book, so really great question, really relevant question. You know, all of us have pain and suffering. Great Buddha philosophy, you know, a life involves 10,000 joys, 10,000 sorrows, and that's just the human condition. And we can use these sorrows as forms of creative growth, and a lot of creative people do. They channel and learn and reflect and grow from their negative experiences. And they also express themselves creatively as a way to express and magnify those experiences for the world. And they find, you know, that it resonates a lot. You know, some of Shakespeare's greatest tragedies, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, they're timeless because they reveal universal truths. And a lot of our suffering, once we share it with the world, we realize just how much we're not alone in this.
But can you say that we need adversity in order to be creative? Can you be creative without adversity?
Yes, you can. What scientists are starting to realize, there's a a higher order factor here, and that's any experience with an unusual, a new and unusual and unexpected experience. So any encounter with an unexpected experience. So it doesn't have to be trauma. It doesn't have to be negative. But it could be a whole wide range of things. For instance, we're now inducing researchers are inducing in the laboratory these kinds of experiences by in the virtual reality environments where they violate the laws of physics.
Huh?
The key here is that something has happened in your life that shatters your assumptions about the world. Something that you always thought about how the world is. Maybe the world is safe, or maybe the world is, you know, whatever. And that changes you and your shift of consciousness and gives you often a purpose, sort of a creative purpose.
You write about something called the orphan effect. What is that?
Yeah, the orphan effect found there's some of the most creative people that make the history books much higher level than the general population lost a parent in childhood, and that's called the orphanhood effect. Again, it doesn't mean you have to lose a parent in order to be creative, but it's just one part of this whole nexus of unexpected experiences or unusual that give you a sort of an outsider's mindset on life.
And I guess out of those traumas, and interestingly, you write most trauma survivors report some kind of positive growth. I think we often think that people who have trauma will never recover. But you're saying that's actually not true, that most people do recover. But I guess you have to look at your life and sort of figure out what the meaning is, right?
You do. We don't mean to belittle at all those who've had trauma or undervalue just how horrible trauma can be. But what we're saying is that even under the seemingly most brutal life experiences can come some meaning. The great psychiatrist Viktor Frankl, who created a whole form of meaning for logotherapy for psychologists, he was in the concentration camps as a kid and wrote about how these people in the camps, knowing they were going to highly expecting they were going to die, created some sort of meaning out of their life.
In fact, you wrote a very brilliant book about that. Let me get Mike from Radnor to join our conversation. Hi, Mike. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
I was wondering if there was anything in a daily routine that you can do to spark creativity. I didn't know if there's anything a normal person who hasn't had a cataclysmic or a mental illness. To really do that.
Sure. No, it's a good question. I mean, in certain ways, this book has some practical advice. So the question is, how do you incorporate that in your life?
Yeah.
Scott?
I want to bring it back to a second. You know, creativity is a lifestyle. We've mentioned things like trauma and we've mentioned things like mental illness and all this stuff. But I want to be clear that all of these things that we talk about in this book are habits that anyone can develop. Creativity is not something in the margins, only for people who have mental illness or have had some sort of horrible experience in life. You know, these are things. So, practical things. I'll stop talking abstractly. You can wake up tomorrow and decide, or right now say, I'm going to be a creative person. And that will require me to go through all these 10 things we talk about in this book. I'm going to be more mindful of and observe, really listen to people when they talk to me and use that for fodder for my art. You know, I'm going to just to understand people for compassion is also a good reason in itself. I'm also going to be more open to new experiences. I'm going to go towards that which I fear. I'm going to make time in my day for daydreaming and solitude. I'm going to make time in my day for meditation practice that strengthens my ability to be flexible. I'm going to try to be more sensitive. I'm going to, all these things we talk about in the book. And these are decisions that you can make. And we do give some tips, but the greatest tip of them all is just to make the decision is to practice these things so they become habits, just like stopping to pick your nails or something, for instance.
Why is sensitivity? How does that figure into creativity?
Creative people seem to be astutely sensitive to their surroundings, and a little pin drop, sounds so loud and cacophonous to the creative person. For creative people, there's an enlarged consciousness there. that all of us can build through these kinds of practices. But being highly sensitive allows you to pick up on things that other people might miss, and then ultimately that will allow you to make connections that other people have missed.
As you were talking about incorporating some of this stuff in your life, I was thinking about in improvisation. There's part of improvisation, a very important part of that is this idea of yes and.
Correct.
In certain ways, I kind of feel like those are words to live by, but the idea of yes and as opposed
yes, you're right.
And. Instead of no but. You know what I mean?
Yes. Yes. I'm just doing yes and.
But I know. I got it.
Yeah, you got it,
it
the third time. But no, you're absolutely right. And I think that so much of life is improv. You know, we try to control things. We can't. Ultimately, the things we try to control are things that we can't. You know, the things that we worry the most about are the things that don't come true. And the things we never worried about are the things that happen.
Right.
You know, and just coming to terms with that fact kind of frees you up to live a more creative life, I think.
Well, we are talking about how to live a more creative life, talking about creativity with our guest, Scott Barry Kaufman, co-author of a new book called Wired to Create. And again, you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We have an email from R, who says, what about laziness and not accepting the world as it is? As an impetus to problem solving. I mean, it seems like people are kind of an excuse just to do nothing.
I love these calls. What procrastination. What if I'm a lazy bastard? Like,
yeah,
what can I do?
Exactly. Okay. What's your language?
Oh, you're sorry. Okay.
Sorry.
What if I'm lazy? Yeah, and it's like, it's one of those things. It's like, you know, some things, you know, can be really idle. Right. Yeah. And can actually be really beneficial to creativity or really beneficial to the creative process. And but, you know, at the end of the day, we need to take some responsibility for our lives, I think. And if we're having a fear or something that's taking us away from a stimulus that could allow us to learn and grow, I think that, you know, we need to take responsibility that maybe we are being lazy and try to and reconcile that.
Yeah. An email from another listener, a psychologist researcher, spoke on creativity at Muhlenberg College a couple of years ago. His research indicated that accountants were the most creative professionals. Any comment on creativity by profession?
Yeah.
I don't know anything about that research, but are there certain professions you think that are more creative than others?
You know, I think that you can find creativity and not creativity in any field. You know, you can have really creative artists. You can have artists that are just after 30, 40 years of doing the same kind of paintings are not innovating in any sort of way. You can be an accountant and, you know, you don't want to be too creative as an accountant or you will go to jail.
Right, exactly. we call it creative accountant.
Yeah, and if you're a pilot, you don't want to be too – you know, there's some things like certainly they don't lend them – they have less wiggle room for how creative you can be. But you can – you know, if you view creativity or essential part of creativity, just seeing new possibilities in any moment, you know, that's something you can do no matter what you're doing, what field you're doing.
Let me see what Diane from – looks like Horsham has to say. Diane, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hello.
Hi there.
I went to school in my early 40s to become an occupational therapist, and I never thought I was creative or raised in a creative environment growing up. When I graduated, I went to work with young children, 3 and under, and I was required to move constantly on my job, adapt minute by minute. And what I found was all of these creative ideas for therapy would come out with the movement. And just wanted to know if your guest could comment on how important movement is in stirring creative ideas.
Well, that's interesting, Diane, the idea of connecting movement, not just walking, I guess, but even just movement and creativity. Have you looked at that, Scott?
Yeah, good research showing on the importance of exercise for cognition, especially intelligence. I don't know if I've seen specifically with creativity, but certainly, you know, some of these intellectual functions are going to be important for creativity. Mm-hmm. Just getting your, you know, it increases your memory. You know, exercise can increase your well-being. And as I said earlier, well-being is tightly connected to creativity. Movement is really essential. And there's a whole new field emerging, a field called positive health. That is showing that mind-body connection and some fascinating studies I talk about in my class on that. So absolutely.
Diane, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Let me see what Mitch has to say. Mitch, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Scott. My name is Mitch.
Hi, Mitch.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm concerned about schools pushing the product over the process. I've been an artist for over 50 years, so I deal with a lot of people who come to the studio to purchase things, and most people are very involved with the product over the process. Artists seem to be, interested in how things are made, but the public doesn't really seem to be concerned with that.
Oh, I love that question.
Mitch, thanks for the call. Go ahead, Scott.
Love that question. And I would completely agree that our society focuses more on achievements than the journey. Completely agree with that, and you see that very clearly in a school situation with our focus on standardized testing and standards. Just the whole idea of standards as opposed to making things revisable. I can go on and on about that. Actually, my previous book, Ungifted, is all about that, Ungifted Intelligence Redefined, if you want to read any more about that. But I completely agree, and I'm really glad you made that point.
Mitch, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Do you have to be a nonconformist to be creative or think like a nonconformist?
It helps. Yeah, it helps. You have to be able to believe in your idea. E. Paul Torrance referred to as being comfortable being a minority of one. Having an idea that or thinking in a certain way, seeing the world a certain way that no one else agrees with, and being comfortable with that.
And the idea, I guess, of mixing both solitude and also being among the herd, right?
Yeah, we can't be 100% out of touch with others, or else they will put you in a mental institution. the way the society we live in. You need to, and it's also important to learn the tradition. So expertise is important. That's another contradiction, or seeming contradiction that creative people are really good at learning the tradition, but they are also really good at going beyond it as well. And a lot of ways in order to go beyond it, you need to know what exists, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah. So what got you interested in creativity?
I've always been a bit weird since my...
It's about yourself? I mean, helping to understand yourself, you think?
I think all research is me-search. I think any psychologist says that.
I actually do, but yes, I appreciate you saying that, yes.
I think creativity is something that wasn't appreciated as a child. I saw all around me, not just with myself, but with other people. And, it's something I really want to champion as an important way of being in this world that doesn't get its full appreciation.
Mm. And why do you think it doesn't?
Because it's easier to deal with people who conform. If you're a manager, if you're a teacher, it makes your job easier if someone's not questioning your assumptions or inventing something new that creates anxiety in you because you don't know how to deal with it.
Do you think there's a connection between creativity and ADD or, whatever letters are used to describe?
Yes.
So many young people or so many people these days.
Yes. The latest neuroscience research, I think, suggests that ADHD, surely it's a deficit of executive functioning or your ability to concentrate on the outside world. But also you could think of it as in a positive way as well, that it's an indication of an overactive imagination. A lot of people with ADHD have an overactive imagination brain network. So in situations where you allow them to engage in their personal stream of consciousness, they show greater flow than people who don't have ADHD. But when we force them to sit in their seats and focus, it's like torture to them because they have an overactive imagination and an executive functioning that makes it hard to concentrate.
Is that you?
Does that describe you? No? I don't know if I have ADHD, but I don't know.
Well, Scott Barry Kaufman, thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And the book is called Wired to Create, Unraveling the Mysteries of the Creative Mind. And again, he's scientific director of the Imagination Institute and a researcher at the Positive Psychology Center at the University of Pennsylvania. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about the program, including how to download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, John Ahrens, and Liz Fiedler. I'm Marty Moscoe. Thank you so much for joining us.